Okay, everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. I am Matthew Raphael Johnson. This is the beginning of August 2016. We're going to deal with somebody today that I'm really surprised I haven't dealt with before. He is a Christian National Socialist, Imperial Russia, died in 1908, and no one's ever heard of him. Even in Russia, and yet at the time, he was extremely important and very influential, to the point where Tsar Alexander III donated money to his cause. And this is Nicholas Napoleon. His primary overriding concern, and this is important to everything that we do here, was that in formal categories, politics, economics, and theology, that these aren't sufficient. These are, at best, abbreviations, ways that we can make things simpler just for the sake of communication, for nothing else. They're not real. What really matters is love. Now, love in the West is a word that now has no meaning, like so many words. And so it's been overused, and it's saccharine, and stupid, and everyone says it, and it's really almost, I'm almost embarrassed to use it. But that's the word to use here, and I think that the best way to define it is that the opposite of love is self-interest. So love is very similar to a humility that's willing to abbreviate yourself for the sake of another's interest. But that interest can't be just any interest. If any movement, if any kind of solidarity is going to develop, then those involved have to put their own self-interest and egos aside for the sake of the common work. When this doesn't happen, there's a tendency that to believe that the people involved are simply not worthy of the project. They don't know how to do this. They're not mature enough to know how to do this. Sacrifice is an extraordinary thing. But this is what love is. It has nothing to do with this kind of saccharine romantic nonsense. It's closely related to the root of the word Philadelphia. The nature of brotherhood and solidarity. The solidarity implies that I'm willing to be harmed, to hurt myself if necessary, for the sake of the common good. This is the opposite of self-seeking. Napoleon is an aristocrat, he's well-educated, and he sees before anything else, he sees that the fall of man, the fall of Adam, which to him was very real, occurred because a demon was able to provoke the passion of pride. Everything comes back to the ego. The minute the ego is let loose from its cultural cage, and worse, justified by the system, there's no controlling it. Just today, I'm reading that the Nestle Corporation is buying up a lot of the water resources in Arizona, and now is bottling those up and selling them at a premium to cities in central Arizona that are suffering badly under drought conditions. Now, like it or not, that's capitalism. Like it or not, that's the free market. Like it or not, that's one of the things that happens when people pursue their self-interest. See, if somebody in those cities had been pursuing his self-interest one way or another, and is, you know, maybe unsuccessful, what grounds does that person have to stand on to condemn Nestle? He has none. It's not his fault that Nestle is a much bigger entity than he is. Nestle is doing no more than anybody who is pursuing their self-interest. The most dangerous thing in the world is to take out this kind of a passion, let it loose, and then justify, tell these people that letting loose with it is okay. The primary issue is self-seeking and therefore pride, and that is the nature of the fall. Harmony and love are very similar. Harmony is the result of solidarity. It's possible to substitute love and solidarity, but for both solidarity and harmony, love is necessary. Love doesn't, it's not quantifiable. It's not necessarily rational all the time, but it's absolutely needed. He is a theologian, as well as a political theorist. And he sees, you know, he's talking about Russia now, the turn of the 20th century. And he sees a lot of the things that we've talked about on this show. He sees the Petrine state coming apart. He sees primarily the worst part of it, the nobility, the people who had many years ago been charged with the rule locally of the realm, long since abandoned Russia, even the Russian language, orthodoxy, the peasantry. And as they mortgaged their land to the point where they could no longer afford it, they moved to the cities. And the minute they moved to the cities, they join the lodge and they become Jacobin. Joining the lodge and becoming a partisan of the French Revolution is essentially one and the same thing. The lodges that came into Russia were very French, were part of the Grand Orient, and were extremely radical. He sees a lot of things at work. And when you see the nobles behaving like this, it doesn't take long for the peasantry, who was supposed to be guided by these people, developing a false idea of what authority is. There are four false conceptions of God that he needs to remove from Christianity entirely. And this is brilliant understanding and a very simple way to put it. Number one, the proud ruler of creation, you know, like the arrogant landlord. That has to go. The second model is this idea that he is, heavens are organized the same way that the royal court is, that saints are like nobles, and the nobles then present your case to the king. It's understandable as a metaphor, but that's not really how it works. Take the metaphors too far. The third is the worst, and this is this idea that God just can't wait to send people to hell. So many rules and so many sins, every little thing you do. And oh well, that's it. You know, you step on the landmine, that's it, it blows up in your face when you're finished. If this has anything to do with the God of the prophets, the God of the New Testament, the God of the Church Fathers, and of course, lastly, is the notion of bribery, that somehow if I do just enough stuff, God will be satisfied with me and be happy with me and forget about everything else that I may have done. There's a concept here, the nature of sin, the nature of the will, we need to take very, very seriously. It's so easy to adopt modern metaphors when it comes to law, transgression, punishment. And for the most part, when people talk about orthodox moral doctrine, they talk about, like they're positivists, that there's laws, and when you transgress them, you are punished. And that punishment is to, A, keep you from doing it again, and B, reforming you internally. Now, that might be true, but only in a very limited sense. A bad act, an evil act, is not really the problem. It's a manifestation of a problem. There's two wills here. And I know I'm reversing the order here, but just bear with me. The first order will is who we really are, what Skovoroda would call the inner heart. This is who we truly have become. Our core fundamental beliefs. This is how we live. This is how we think. The art that's in our homes. This is how this is what gets us angry. The visceral aspects of our identity. Everything that we are. Undeniable. This is who we are. And then the second order, the outer heart or the empirical self, is how we function day to day. Generally speaking, even among the greatest of saints, those two entities have nothing in common with each other. Now, the empirical self is always going to fail. The empirical self is always going to fall because we're born into a world and we're raised and hardwired into a world that is absolutely diseased. I didn't become Orthodox until grad school. I was long since hardwired into this rotten world before then. And I experienced no grace at all until then. No, that's not the point. We do something wrong, we're aware of it. But that's the same thing as a bourgeois goodness. I mean, that's not important. No, the point is, what is it about us that led to that happening in the first place? So you make a political comparison here. We talk about something like illegal immigration. We talk about how terrible it is and what damage they do. But that's not really the issue. The issue is, how is it that the U.S. is in such a state where millions of them have been let in without any problem at all over 30, 40 years? What happened? And what is it about the American mentality, elite or otherwise, that led to this happening? And only recently has this been a huge issue, a mainstream issue. That's the difference that I'm talking about here. Sin isn't an act. Sin is the ground of the act. This is why the greatest of saints can say that they're the worst of sinners. Because their empirical self is always screwing up. It's usually not their fault. We always are confessing involuntary sins. It's right in our prayer books. But the phenomenal self is always going to do these things. Half the time, we don't realize it until afterwards. No, what matters is what can be perfect, what can be completely enclosed and on God is the noumenal self, the inner heart, the real person, the constitution, so to speak, of with the ground of our acts. That is the problem. Now, if that is diseased, this is what asceticism is aimed at. Asceticism isn't aimed necessarily at acts that the individual acts that we might do. We're always going to screw up. That's not hypocrisy. That's just inconsistency. Hypocrisy only deals with the inner self. When you claim that there's this inner self that doesn't exist, you don't really believe the thing your politician is spouting off nonsense for the sake of votes. That's hypocrisy. He doesn't really believe it. Hypocrisy is a division between the phenomenal and noumenal self. Our struggle is with the noumenal self. This is why we're constantly asking forgiveness for sins, because we're always sinning. In fact, any action we take whatsoever is sinful because it's self-regarding. So if you want to get stupid about it, this is where we can, you know, if you read the canons in their fullness, especially those of John the Faster, you end up saying, well, there's nothing I can do that isn't a sin. And you are right. That's not the point. The point is, why would you be doing those sins in the first place? What is it about your makeup, including those things that are not your fault, like your upbringing, your society that you were born into? And we're born into a vicious pagan society that despises any kind of moral restraint. You know, we're hardwired into that. That's how the human brain works. That doesn't prevent us, however, from building a rational Orthodox life and making it the foundation of our person. Yeah, we're rotten people and we're always going to screw up. That's not really the issue. You're not going to go to hell for that. And that's not what hell is anyway. The question is your noumenal self. And this is one of these things that, you know, moderns use terms like sin and law and transgression. We're not even using the word in the same way. Usually, the ancients used ourselves in our actions. They're referring to the noumenal self, knowing full well that we make mistakes. I mean, that's not a philosophical interest. All that really matters is who we are and what we have built. So if you're dissatisfied with that, your job then is to pull yourself apart, all aspects of your life, and then slowly put them back together with God at the center. I did that in grad school. It was a painstaking process, but that has everything to do with my consistency and focus later on. It's a painful process, and you will lose friends, and people will hate you for it, and they won't get it. So what? You suffer. You know, people suffer. Again, the only thing that matters is not this phenomenal question. The question is this noumenal self. So now, Napoleon. It's a very similar idea. Corruption reaches its peak when selfish acts that everyone commits become the very center of our identity, and even the very center of the Constitution, in a broad sense, where self-interest is considered the normal run of things, and is justified. So it's like going to an alcoholic and saying, well, there's really no such thing as alcoholism. Everyone does it. You know, nothing you could do about it. This is human nature. You know, it's a really stupid thing to say to an alcoholic, and that's what the modern world says to us. Now, he doesn't mention, in terms of his false ideas of God, he doesn't mention the overindulgent God. But what he means there is same thing as bribery. Stupid statements that if we're just phenomenally good, you know, if we are empirically good and do all the right things that don't get us in trouble with our neighbors, we're going to go to heaven. The really stupid, superficial, almost infantile ways to approach this kind of thing. None of that even makes sense. That has nothing to do with the church, and that's the tragedy of modern, superficial, positivist ideas slowly creeping their way in, because this is how our words are defined. We read, when we're reading scriptures or church fathers, we come across a word like sin or act or action or law or consequence or punishment. And they're not talking about the same things as we are. And we're at a point now where unless you understand that, nothing can continue. We can't even have a conversation. Holiness is when the noumenal self is fixed. Bourgeois goodness is when the phenomenal self is fixed. You understand the distinction here. The phenomenal self can be completely fake. It could be a big show, a mask, a prosopon, the mask that we wear for others, or that others, people wear for others. If you're wearing a mask, there's something wrong with you already. Why do you think you need to do that? And what is this mask covering up? Bourgeois goodness is when we could put on that mask and everyone thinks we're wonderful. Well, we don't beat our kids, we're not axe murderers, so we're good. And that's pretty much what the standard is now. Holiness, however, is the end to duplicity and the end to ambiguity and a lack of integrity. And that is when the noumenal self, the inner self, has been reconstructed in a harmonious kind of a way. The Antichrist, both as a concept and as a person, or as a group of people, will arrive without anyone noticing when concepts like this aren't understood by the bulk of the population. The very fact that people think that the Antichrist must be a person, as if Satan is so crude and to be so obvious about it. No, it couldn't be an institution that functions like a person. Or something like in the Kabbalah, Adam Kadmon, or this new man that the revolutionaries are supposed to be able to create. Adam Kadmon is the Antichrist. Well, it is an individual. The golem is an individual, technically. But Satan wouldn't be so crude as to create this individual and put him in power, announcing that he is now the world ruler. That doesn't make any sense. You'd have to be an idiot to accept something like that, even for secular reasons. No, the Antichrist is going to function when words like I'm speaking to you now fall on deaf ears, when you don't know the distinction. So people will be able to say that the world ruler, I mean, Antichrist is here. The world ruler isn't recognized because he's not a person running a government. That's crude. Satan is way too smart for this. He's not going to be so blatant as to have world government, you know, one body with one army and one dictator at the head of everything performing fake miracles. No one would accept this. No one would accept this. He is not going to be that crude. But this is a result of what happens when positivist, superficial legal categories seep in to the faith. So this is how Napoleon and really common sense begins approaching these kind of things. He wants to say that there has to be a balance between love and reason. Reason is kind of like a mask. It can justify anything. Reason and rationalization are very, very close. I can make a case for any political point of view you want me to, and I can make it almost irrefutable. That doesn't mean it's true, but I can make the case. Reason is in and of itself a dangerous tool. It has to be directed like anything else. But what directs it? Does it automatically mean that which directs it is irrational because it's not based on reason? Well, it may be rational, but not necessarily subject to rational delineation. This is what love is. You know, a little kid has a far greater understanding of love because he doesn't know how to analyze it logically. The minute we start doing that, we know that have no idea what love is. Reason and love have to balance each other, but love has to come first. The solidarity and devotion to our fellow man for all the right reasons, that is the foundation. That's our upbringing and everything else. And only from there can reason then work. Reason has to have something to work on. It doesn't give itself its own ends and its own purposes. So there are three different forms of disharmony that he sees in the world. Number one, the rule of passion. And by passion, I mean something that acts upon us. We get the word patient from passion, as in a hospital patient. Passion means we're passive. It's something that controls us. Anger, sadness, these things control us. We would love to control them, but we can't. When that rules, you know, and this is what I'm talking about really with self-interest. Passion is ruling here, not reason, when Nestle is trying to monopolize water of Arizona and the Southwest and selling it to people who are really suffering. So Nestle will be able to figure out a way to use science so to make this as efficient as possible. Then, of course, the rule of simple desire, or the rule of sensation, as he calls it, but worst of all, is a rule by itself of reason. You're talking about a world of Mr. Spock's here. So Nestle will be able to do this to you and very, without any concern for your well-being, explain, well, this is my self-interest, and we all know what Adam Smith said about self-interest, and therefore what I'm doing is perfectly justified. And they're able to, because they don't have love or feeling or devotion, they're able to walk away and feel themselves completely satisfied and justified in their irrational behaviors. The modern world sees truth as the same thing as profit. I don't mean profit in the formal sense, as you know, selling something more than you bought it for. I mean profit, any kind of self-seeking. The self-seeking usually comes at someone else's expense. Cicero defines natural law as precisely the opposite of this. That no action that you do can come at someone else's expense. And by someone else, it's not just some random someone else, but your fellow friend and citizen, Aristotle having defined those two things very similarly. Friends, again, another word that has no meaning anymore. It meant a civic activist. It meant someone who is working with a group of like-minded people for the sake of building civilization. It's a moral category, not just some personal residual. So these kind of disharmonies exist when people behave like animals, or they behave like calculating machines, or they simply allow themselves to be ruled by their drives and emotions. Every time I go by at one of these strip clubs on the road, I say, "Oh my God, how could anyone possibly think that deliberately provoking the male libido is a good thing?" And expecting them to go home and say, "Oh, I'm turning it off now," like a light switch. Who came up with this? How could anyone possibly think this is a smart thing? But this is the irrationality of the sexual revolution. And worse, the same feminist whose leftist friends developed this concept, the sexual revolution, 40 years ago, will now criminalize the inevitable results of this kind of action. So they'll deliberately provoke the male libido, then throw him in prison for doing what the male libido demands that he does. The Brock Turner case is one of the most laughable. He's now out of the news. Most people don't even know who he is, but the kid didn't do anything wrong, at least from the point of view of typical college ethics. He didn't have sex with the girl, and his life is over. Love attempts to reconcile reason and desire and social life. And one of the ways it does this is through a concept that's come on this show before. It's essential to the social ethics of Skovoroda in Ukraine, and that is vocation. And that is a notion that the heart, the soul of every person contains this purpose. A socially useful thing that you're very good at, that makes you happy, that you would actually die for. It's not just a career, but it's why you're here. That is the connection. That is where social life, love, and reason all come together. Finding that is difficult, but it's certainly not going to happen when everyone is herded into a factory, and it's not going to happen when everyone is working three jobs, if they can find three jobs, and still not be able to pay their bills. The most horrible thing I hear in a workplace setting is just be happy you have a job, as if a job is some sort of a gift that's given to people that we should be thankful for. No conception at all of what work is. No conception at all of why they're here. The concept of vocation is essential to social life, to happiness, to devotion, to any kind of rationality whatsoever. What you do and who you are can't be that different from one another. This is the essential concept of the Christian socialism of Napoleon. Really, hell for him is just a, it's not this place that God has created, this terrible torture chamber, where he's going to send people who may have ate a sausage on a Friday, you know, 3 years ago. Now, people will tell you that this is the case. This is what God is. And yet the Psalms say, very famous psalm, and says that God is very much like a father to his children. He forgives the sins in the exact same way. So if by that model, your child comes up to you, four-year-old, we're pretty much less than that in God's eyes, crying, saying, I did the same thing, stupid thing again. And of course, that conception of God will take him and smash his head against the wall. Well, not even, because he would die then. No, he would torture him for the rest of his life. That's the model of God. The psalm says that as a father is towards his children, so is God to those who turn to him. In other words, that same love, even greater, and devotion are there. It doesn't fit with this model. That's simply not how it works. That model develops because we're obsessing about what we can see. The quantitative act, and we see someone driving like an idiot or stealing money. Well, okay, that's bad. But it doesn't answer the question. The question is, why are they like this? Why do they think it's okay? And what, I mean, if it's not okay, then why are they doing it? Why are they driven to do this? What are the conditions? And so now you're talking about something very, very different. This is what evil is. This is what sin is. Not the stupid thing that everyone does. If that were the case, no one would ever be saved, ever, under any circumstances. So when the greatest monks and the holiest of men say that they're the worst of sinners, I want to say, so you're going to hell then, right? What are they going to say? I mean, ultimately, if you're that humble, then maybe your soul's not worth saving, if it's really that bad. Now, they're talking about two different things. The inner self, which is where vocation is, which is where your real self is, that's what you have to worry about. That's what you have to build. That's what the regime can't take away from you. Who are you intellectually, professionally, spiritually? And all of that has to be coherently connected to each other. And once you master that, I've done that myself, and it's taken 20 years and a huge amount of work and pain to get that way. That's the very definition of integrity. Everything is integrated together. It can be done. Everything has to fit together. There can't be any loose ends. It has to be coherent. I mean, there's always going to be problems. That's just how it is. But that's what matters. Now, am I always going to act that way? No way. No, I'm a jerk most of the time. You know, I'd rather punch you out than talk to you about Hegel. You know, but that's irrelevant. The point is, what is the inner heart? Who are you? That's what can be perfect. That is where grace resides. That's where vocation resides. That's where non-alienated labor resides. That's where justice resides. In the end times, and he was convinced we're heading in that direction, a tiny flock of people who think like this will remain. Orthodox people who recognize that canons and rules are abbreviations. They have to do with the phenomenal self. I remember Father John Whiteford said a long time ago, he was talking about the ROCOR anathema against ecumenism from 1983. And his opponent was saying that, well, such and such a bishop has said, you know, some ecumenical stupidity, and therefore he's out of the church. And Father John, I think very rightly said, it doesn't work that way. This isn't a machine. This isn't a courtroom. That's a metaphor. It doesn't actually, and he used the metaphor of a landmine. He said, it's not a landmine. An anathema is not this thing buried in the ground. You step on it and it blows up in your face. You say the wrong thing and it blows up in your, that's simply not how it works. Any law or rule of the church is an expression of the truth and the foundational truth of what Christ said and the prophets and the scriptures. Only when there's a problem, only when there's some error that's crept in for some reason, does something that has already been there have to be clarified. The whole center, the centerpiece of apophatic theology is that words are very, very, very poor examples as a means of communication. Words show a tiny percentage of what we really mean. The words of scriptures are extremely bad, especially today in our modern English, but they've always been that way. The truth that Christ is speaking of can't be contained in words, but unfortunately it has to be, because you can't talk to anyone about it unless it is. Grace will then bridge that gap. But and Gogol says this as well in his letters and elsewhere. The word is, unfortunately, very weak. especially for us. It is an abbreviation at the very, very, very most. It doesn't contain the fullness of the thing. So these anathemas, these canons, are very, very important, of course, but they have to be understood that way. They are bits and pieces of a very, very deep fundamental substance that's really all one thing. But these words, especially when they're interpreted by moderns, don't even begin to express the 1% of the fullness of the content that's being expressed here. That comes from a lifetime of struggle. Now, what does that have to do with anything? That preface is essential. We're talking about Christian socialism. We're talking about social life revolution. Nothing is going to work unless the internal man has been altered as well. Revolutionaries, you know, the leftist socialist types, believe that when the right people take over government, the people who had the least amount of morals shoot their way into Congress, in the boardrooms of the big companies, and kill enough people to make sure that they are solidified in power, that when that happens, and they unfurl the banners and all the slogans are put out there and everyone's herded into the factories, that people will then convert to the truth of Marxism or anarchism, whatever it is. That internally somehow that external violence will have a magical application to the internal life. And of course, it never does. The internal life has never changed. This has been a problem of Christianity since its inception. You can talk about an empire that is Christian, and some have been very successful in this regard. But as individuals, people are still rotten. And people can be still rotten while remaining quite holy. Because who they really are, their deep noumenal self, isn't always represented in their phenomenal acts. The question is, why do they act that way? It can either be something wrong with their noumenal self, or that there's something wrong with the society. Why is there, or there's a problem, there's a disease, there's a mental problem, there's a disconnect, a short circuit, whether internal or external, that is creating this. What he did then, with this in mind, is talk about a brand new form. Really, it's not even a brand new form. It's a patristic idea, what we would call socialism. But it's brand new only because we think of socialism as materialist and statist and Marxist. And that shows you the power of the Rothschild clan. The First International, Karl Marx, kicked out all the actual workers. You know, I've said a million times, and I'll say a million times more in writing and on the radio, that Soviet Marxism had nothing to do with labor. Had nothing to do with workers, that they weren't relevant. It had to do with the party, power, and the control over resources, and to be able to control an economy from one central place. That was far more important than whether or not workers are paid $1 an hour or $1.50 an hour. Now, so when that happened, of course, the followers of Proudhon, the followers of Bakunin, these kind of anarchists, whether idealists or otherwise, I mean, Proudhon was an idealist, Bakunin was a materialist, all thrown out, Proudhon had been dead for some time. Bakunin was still around, but their followers were quite powerful. The First International saw Marx taking a nice dollop of Rothschild money to redefine this concept. So now the world is divided between capitalists and socialists. They're supposed to be opposites, but they're exactly the same. One faction of the ruling class likes one, the other faction likes the other. Karl Marx made sure to throw out all actual workers and absolutely was outraged. If you read Paul Johnson's Intellectuals, he will give an account of Karl Marx's rage and screaming and yelling when it was suggested to him that workers should actually have something to do with a Marxist government. The most outrageous concept, he thought it was. And Bakunin and the anarchists were kicked out. And Bakunin then wrote later on, very famously, "It's amazing how much power that Rothschild money has." He attacked the Jews, saying the Rothschilds, and they're creating this Jewish ethnic movement and pretending that it's socialism. So that's the unfortunate thing. You know, folk music gets hijacked by commercialism and the left, and socialism gets hijacked by internationals who don't give a damn about society or labor. And the fact is that the patristic, the church fathers, with very few exceptions, rejected private property exclusively. That any claim to private property was absolutely outrageous. St. Ambrose was the most vehement here. And that when private property dominates, that ruling group then uses the state for their own purposes. create wars just for their own profit rather than for defense. And of course, he's talking about senatorial Rome, not the empire. The emperor, of course, was more powerful than the senators, and that's why it was a far more just society than the oligarchy. They rejected private property entirely. Now, by private property, we don't mean your toothbrush or your house or your bicycle. We're referring to capital, that which can produce the things that are socially necessary. When Karl Marx referred, this is another one of these phrases that no one knows what it means anymore, private property didn't mean your personal property. It meant capital. The idea of privately owned capital in the church fathers was absolutely outrageous. Part of the reason was that because it automatically represses the idea of vocation. Now, how are we to recreate? I mean, Napoleon sees this disease coming into Russia. Russia is a little slow in that regard because the monarchy had protected it against some of the worst elements of Western egocentrism. But he is seeing it with the French penetration, the British penetration in Russian life intellectually and economically. It comes from the late part of Alexis's reign and Sophia and then Peter the Great, who was the first revolutionary, the first Bolshevik in Russia, and attempted to create this brand new noble class that had nothing to do with Russia at all and didn't even speak the language. Peter was, of course, a Freemason, had been, according to Robert Massey, his main biographer, had been initiated in Holland in his great embassy. He sees the results of this. The results of this are egocentrism, the market, the belief in profit, thriving at someone else's expense. And the average American is going to say, well, that's how everybody is. You're being stupid. Unfortunately, only an alienated American can say that. Yeah, I mean, I get it. That's all we see 24 hours a day. When we see someone decent out there, we wonder what his angle is. Well, there was a time in history where that wasn't the case. The things that are normal in American life would have sent you to the gallows 200 years ago, especially in a place like Russia. The peasant commune is the absolute essential institution, both economically and as an ideal, almost a metaphor for the entire country. Self-seeking was absolutely out of the question. Self-seeking, in fact, was not rational, but that creates a personality. I mean, not everything is, well, we have to be communal because it's in our interest to be communal. That's stupid. Beyond that, though, creating these communities and living for one another and having no option in that respect, it creates a personality where this sort of thing is normal. So, for example, in the Russian peasant commune, if a woman's husband is killed in warfare, it was understood that the commune would take care of the household. When it came to harvest time, that would be taken care of by guys who had nothing to do. Anybody who they were finished already, you take care of her. And this wasn't like they had to force them to do this. It was understood. Today, it would be a riot to get anyone to do that. But back then, it was understood because the personality that was created by the commune, or in urban areas, the artel or the small union, that personality is very different from what we're talking about in modern America. I have an essay on my from a long time ago making fun of that idiot in England, Wendy Slater. Oh, what a phony. She's not even pretty. I wonder who hired her. You know, it's not for her brains, that's for sure. Stupid article on trying to argue that, you know, American capitalism and old Russia were the same in terms of its merchant class. And she doesn't even mention the old believers once. Well, how can you write a paper on the merchant classes in Russia, not mentioning the old believers? That's how ignorant she is. She is tenured. I think she's at Oxford or something like that. And this is the crap that's going on in academia. And I just kind of make fun of her. You know, it's really hard. I mean, I can't. She's obviously, you know, I don't know. Maybe she knows someone, or maybe she's just, you know, really good in bed. I don't know why they gave her tenure. But reading this thing, I'm realizing that she has the same attitude. Well, everyone's like this. Everyone's like me. I'm a ladder climber. I do what I need to do to get ahead. And so they were the same way back then. Can you imagine a historian acting like this? This is exactly what she does. The old believers weren't like that. Any prophet, the old believer life, even if it wasn't in there, what Americans would call self-interest, it went to the community. Even if it hurt them to do it. The pain doesn't matter. My personal phenomenal pain is totally irrelevant. What's real is what's noumenal. So the way to create and to rebuild, to recreate this mentality, he created the Brotherhood of the Holy Cross. The labor brotherhood, of the Holy Cross. It was a Christian socialist, ethnic nationalist, very, very orthodox set of institutions. It was a cellular structure throughout Russia that was going to reinvigorate that which was already there, but what was clearly decaying. These were self-governing communes, peasant ownership in a communal structure based around mutual aid. And the central issue was schooling. They had their own schools, language, really law, history, and but that was also paralleled with, you know, livestock, horticulture, because these things weren't really different. You know, Puglia's central idea is that there is no distinction in reality between theology, economics, and politics, history. These are artificial distinctions. Whenever we act for a purpose. That purpose can be justified by an appeal to some greater purpose. By the time you're finished, you're talking about the purpose of the world and creation. So the tiniest little action can be traced back to God that way. There, very simply, I've shown that there is no distinction between these fields. Economics is about production and consumption. Well, why are we consumed? Why do we produce? If we want to be happy, you want to go, well, why is that an important thing? Why do we want to avoid pain? Why do we want to improve the society around us? Wallowing in mud is just as good. A lot of people do that, you know. And so if you push these people, eventually they'll end up saying, but, you know, we have this spiritual entity, this spiritual center, this what is created by God is within us, this vitality that drives us to this this kind of action. The vitalism is, I'm not endorsing vitalism by any means, but it's absolutely essential here. That's what labor is all about. These kids were finding their vocation. And even the vocations were organized in different houses, and each house had its own head. The key was, how do you develop a society where all of these then can work with each other? Every vocation, I mean, it could be being an intellectual or a clergyman or a construction worker, or a physician, all of these were strictly seen as equal. One can't exist without the other, but very different personalities have to be present to want to be one of these things. There is no justification for one being treated better than another. What he sees in the West is that a complete inversion, the satanic inversion, the carnival made permanent, where the merchant and the usurer is the most extraordinary, revered figure, where, of course, natural law states and every other society that ever existed, it is the lowest figure. Because although they're occasionally necessary, they really are manipulators. They're not really producers. They misuse words for the sake of trying to convince you to do something that you probably shouldn't do. But in the West, these people rule entire societies. He is horrified by thinking that that might happen in Russia. It almost did in the 1990s, where these people took over for a short period of time. He notices that outside of the old believers, that merchant class in Russia is exclusively Jewish, that were organizing into kahals, speaking Yiddish, making sure that no one else knew what they were doing. He absolutely noticed this. The old believers were the only reason there were Gentiles involved in Russian merchantry at all. He notes that in the apocalypse, for example, there are three horses, the white, the red, and the black. And he interprets these, of course, the faith, the white horse is the Orthodox Church, but warfare, coming from egocentrism, this belief that I'm right and I will impose myself on you, creates warfare, but that creates the black horse, which he says is usury. It is the merchant class, because wars, the nastier they get, they desperately need money. The larger the state gets to pursue these wars, it needs the banker. No matter how you slice it, self-interest ends up creating an oligarchy. If you reject solidarity, if you reject humility, you then enshrine mammon as your god. And that means you enshrine interest as your god, which means that you enshrine slavery. Because in America, most of what people work for is paying off the interest of the interest of the interest. And I don't mean that necessarily in quantitative, but also in qualitative terms. War leads to usury, and in fact, he says that they're really not that different from one another. Being egocentric costs far more than it provides. So even from the point of view of egocentrism, it fails. It's contradictory in every respect. His brotherhood of labor grew tremendously in Russian life. 1901, by his own report, it brought in 82,000 rubles. Now, trying to figure out what that means, I figured out to be $25,420 in 1901, revising it to 2016, roughly. You're talking six figures. You're talking $550,000, depending on how you use the method. The 3.2 rubles per dollar, roughly around the 1870s. And if you want to say that, 0.31 rubles per dollar. And therefore, you try to figure out what the dollar is. It's sort of like your $1 today is roughly $20 in 1900. So that means in 1901, he's bringing in an extraordinary amount of money. He has many children at his schools. He has the blessing of the local bishop. Alexander III has donated money and says that this is very, very important. He, number one, focuses on the services, prayer, communal prayer. Number two, the work in especially agriculture, but he had factories as well. Number three, the question of equality, that all vocations are equal. They're not the same, but they're all equal. And finally, that everything has to have its ground in love, the way we've been talking about. And he defines it in his later works. It defines it not so much in and of itself. But you know something is a result of love, because love creates peace, patience, and integration. Someone says that you have integrity. They usually don't know what they mean. Integrity means that all aspects of your life and the society around you, if the society is healthy, have been successfully synthesized in yourself to create a focused individual self, a person. The opposite of that would be somebody who has one personality for their boss, one personality for their wife, one personality for their church. That's something that is to be condemned. I personally have gone out of my way to make sure that's never the case. I'm always the same no matter where I am, one personality, one set of priorities. And when I see people behaving differently, putting on, and I've seen some very extreme examples of this, the question is, why is it that they have been led to believe that really, and then they have to wear these masks to get by, and then are there real people under there? Is there a real individual? You take those masks away, who's left? For him, there's no separation between religious thought and social life. Religion is never individual. It doesn't make sense. Liturgy itself, its Greek word, means the common labor. Class rule is absolutely unjustifiable. When I say class, in this case, I don't mean vocationally. I mean, a few centuries ago, class referred to vocation, function. Today, it refers to income. He's using it to refer to income. Class rule, meaning the rule of the wealthy over others, is unjustified. There's nothing special about money, and usually people who have amassed a huge amount of it don't deserve it. They don't work that hard. If they cured cancer, maybe, but none of these people have. And something important, stop obsessing about externals. The external is the same thing as a mask. He's not rejecting liturgy or prayers or law or the canons or anything like that. But you notice, you read the works in the Soviet Union of so-called Patriarch Sergius in Moscow. I don't judge the man. He was tortured. No judgment of him. But he didn't violate any canons. He was quite proper in everything he did, but he served the Soviet Union and destroyed the church. Obviously, the externals of the canons aren't sufficient. And actually, they can be used to destroy the church. External piety is phenomenal, not noumenal. Therefore, it's false. Unless, of course, it comes from the noumenal. And that way, you wouldn't have to make a show of it being external. Socialism, for him, it really is. Socialism has been hijacked like so many other things. And in his mind, the atheist materialist parties movements have come into existence because others have, the church has not, or the state has not, developed this firm ideological sense of social equality in the true sense of the word. Now, the church has been dispossessed of all of their property and money under Peter the Great, and even worse, under Catherine. The church itself can't be blamed for this. They had nothing. All their income went to the state, thanks to the 18th century. But this Apuleius idea created an entire generation of Christian socialists who wanted to create not just a just society, but the person that has to create it and is then produced by it, which is far more important than the actual institutions. Institutions in and of themselves aren't, they're as good as the people who run them. He rejects the idea. One of his big points is the idea of unsystematic charity. He hates that notion. It's the idea that the system can remain as it is, but rich people can on occasion give money to those who need it. He says that's the word. He would rather have them not give money at all, because in that case, it relieves their conscience without actually having done anything. Unsystematic charity is a safety valve for the oligarchy. Charity has to be the foundation of social life, not something that you do on occasion. Private charity in the American oligarchy, for example, is where Buffett and the head of Microsoft, who are together in Berkshire Hathaway, as you remember, maybe a decade ago, they gave away, quote unquote, gave away $5 billion to charity. Again, big quotes there. And people are so stupid and dumbed down, they think that that's a wonderful thing. And, I rolled my eyes and I said, they just bought the entire charitable institutional system in America. That's what they just did. They didn't give it to people who needed it. They bought institutions, whether it could be Oxfam, I don't remember who it was exactly, but dozens of these sorts of organizations. NGOs are nothing more than the political action of corporate interests. Every, you look at, homosexual rights NGOs or Amnesty International, look at who they are. A laundry list of corporate donors for every last one of them. That's who they are. That's unsystematic charity. That has to end. It has nothing to do with charity. It has nothing to do with love. It has nothing to do with helping anybody. It's just another way of the powerful. On the one hand, they could relieve their conscience. On the other hand, they could use that money to further their domination in a different way, in a way that people don't expect. Life of students in the Labor Brotherhood was structured almost like a monastic structure. Families functioned. They had their own plots and everything else. This wasn't a monastery in that sense of the word, but it was a monastic idea, but made far broader and far freer on that level. And I want to conclude this by saying that it worked. It was very successful. It was growing substantially. And even as it's growing, even as its students, people who came out of this, were quite different than those who had not. They had a completely different mentality. Remember, the word education, another one of these words, no one knows what it means anymore. Education had nothing to do with schooling. I mean, schooling was one small manifestation of it. But education meant everything having to do with your culture and how the next generation is brought up. So it would include parenting, it would include media, it would include churches, it would include ideology, everything that the child is exposed to. That's what education is, not just schooling. And everything else is just, of course, in the private sector, therefore we have no right to talk about it. But in his case, it was a structured life based on absolute solidarity, and the income for each of the houses was divided equally. And there were no exceptions to this, because even if someone had done better or worked a little bit harder, there's a reason for this. The reason for this that has no merit necessarily to their own. There's a reason for this. There's a reason why they're doing things. And of course, the way that these things are structured, it was very difficult for one person just to slack off. You join this community, it's understood that you are going to work the same level as everybody else. And you're not doing this for your own purposes. You're doing this for the betterment of your soul, as well as the family and society around you. You're living a life as naturally as possible. What we live today is unnatural. Pursuing profit in the broad sense of the word is unnatural and bizarre. it doesn't satisfy anybody. The richest people in the world don't just retire. They continue to collect and demand and seek more. And if it's not money, then maybe it's women or maybe political power or something else. You know, buying universities, whatever it takes, it never ends. So therefore, that's not satisfying. That's not what we're here for. Business senses is necessary. But no one has earned as much as the Carnegie, the Rothschilds ever earned. It's not earned. It's expropriated. Those who are extraordinary because they were born and raised in a healthy society. Extraordinary people exist because of their genetic background, because they were encouraged, because of the books that they were given, the encouragement that they were given. That's not their merit. And so to profit from it more than little is absolute false teaching. So the stress here was equality, not sameness by any means. Vocations, functions, personalities, these are always different. Society couldn't function with just one personality. But to accept inequality is to say that the doctor is more important than the policeman. That's stupid. The doctor couldn't function without the policeman, and vice versa. He sees Russia losing its national identity. He sees compartmentalization. In other words, one person is one way in the economy, another way at church. You know, one set of ethics there, another set of ethics somewhere else. The intellectuals were a disaster. Ideology, to the extent it existed at all, ideology is simply too abstract. The intellectuals were promoting these utopian ideas of socialism. It doesn't actually include workers or people. They're categories. They're myths. My doctoral dissertation was on this phenomenon. You have these ideals and myths in George Sorrell's sense of the term myth. And then you win the revolution and you realize that, well, wait a minute, you have to deal with actual people now. So you have a huge gap between ideology and people. That gap is filled by force. That's the nature of a revolution in its violent stage. And that's Michael Oakeshott's work on rationalism, and that was my doctoral dissertation. So it had to do with the abuse of language and ideals in a revolutionary situation. Revolution, again, in the broad sense of the term. And the same situation occurs here, and we said this already. Revolutionary group takes power, for better or for worse, realizing that now we can't just talk about this stuff in the abstract. We're talking about actual people and families and workers. Bolsheviks, not caring about any of that stuff, it didn't bother them. But revolutions have a tendency to fail for that reason, that they can't make that switch. In the Bolshevik case, the U.S. and the West was constantly bailing them out with food aid, so their economic disasters weren't a big problem. And then American industrialists built their fundamental heavy industry, so really their own stupidity wasn't relevant. And that was Trotsky's whole thing, and then it became Stalin's whole thing. The concept of harmony between mind and body, between society and family, the nesting of the symphonic personalities of the family, the commune, the parish, the locality, the nation, and the church as a whole. All of these, both internally, in terms of our own mind and functioning, as well as the external world around us and how these institutions work, have to exist and have to function integrally, like a symphony. That's why the concept of symphony is so important in Orthodox political thinking. And that institutions are expressions of this harmony. They're not goods in and of themselves. Synods aren't holy in and of themselves. They're institutions of convenience. They're essential, you know, they're part of the empirical world. They're there to organize things. They're usually a pain more than anything else. They don't rule the church in the sense that God rules the heavens. That's not how it works. That's not the concept of rule that they meant. We're talking about something based on love, charity, and solidarity. Those are not abstractions. In this day and age, we're fighting and bleeding for each other. We know what that word means. And that's why Christian socialism is so important. Thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.